All right. Good morning, everybody. Stephen Molyneux from Free Domain. And lovely questions from the lovely people on X, x.com/Stephen Molyneux. If a prominent Christian teacher who spent years publicly promoting virtue, strong marriage, family values, and Christian principles suddenly announces his divorce from his wife after a long marriage and raising 7 children together, in your opinion, does this invalidate or undermine the credibility of all his prior teachings on those topics? What immovable object, if any, would justify separation, despite the Bible teaching that divorce is only permissible for adultery? Well, it's a very interesting question, and I am of two minds about this as a whole. It is the question of, if someone is fat, right? You've heard me say this a million times before, if someone is fat, can they sell a diet book? If someone is a chain smoker, can they sell a smoking cessation program, right? Can I sell miracle hair growth with my excessively bald pate? So it's an interesting question. As a whole, we need to be efficient in life. And we do not have, in our short mortal span, time to examine everyone's crazy system. So I think it makes sense that if I promote peaceful parenting, I mean, the first thing would be to ask is, A, am I a parent? B, am I an involved parent? And C, do I have a good relationship with my child or children? And of course, I am a parent. I have been a very involved parent because I've had the joy and privilege and bliss of working from home and homeschooling my daughter. We have spent a huge amount of time together and we enjoy each other's company. Occasionally, she pops up on this show and we have a lot of fun and all of that. So hopefully that makes some kind of sense. So if there is something that is unusual that is coming down the pipeline, if somebody says, you know, the all bacon and margarine diet is the way to health, like all bacon, all margarine, right? Someone comes along. If they don't appear to be healthy, what do you know? Well, if they're following their own diet and all other things being equal, if they're following their own diet and are like obviously unhealthy, like obese or something like that, if they're following their own diet and they're obese, then it's pretty tough for them to say with credibility that the diet is healthy. If they are not following their own diet, but they're claiming that this diet is essential and healthy and good and great and all of that, then we have the problem that this man claims to care about his diet, claims it's the best thing, but doesn't follow his own diet, which means it's kind of a con. It cannot be true that something is essential, important, but you don't do it yourself. Especially if you're hiding that you don't do it yourself. Let's say that the guy hires a fit guy who doesn't follow his diet to be on the cover of his diet book or something like that. If I say telling the truth is important, but I'm some pathological liar, then I clearly don't think that the truth is important. I just say it, which is kind of a con. If you say a virtue or value is important and you don't follow it yourself, then you're lying because there's something of more importance than that value for yourself. And this is particularly true of unusual things. So, you know, Jordan Peterson, Michaela Peterson, when she's not chasing a crazy guy inhabited by a demon called Igor, I'm not kidding about that, look it up. They say all beef, is that the carnivore diet, the lion diet, or the all beef diet is the way to go. That's the thing to do for sure, for sure, for sure. Well, that's an unusual situation. It's an unusual diet choice. It's an unusual thing to hear about. It goes very much against the grain, which is fine. I mean, I go against the grain in a lot of ways too, so I'm not condemning that out of hand, of course, but it's a very unusual approach to dieting. So we would expect positive outcomes for these things. So given that we don't have time to evaluate and experiment on ourselves, there are probably at least 100,000 different dietary approaches in the world, 10,000 or something like that. So given that we don't have the time to experiment upon ourselves all these different dietary options, we have to do a shorthand or shortcuts, which has to do with, okay, so this person says this diet is important. Are they following it themselves? And if they are following it themselves, are they having beneficial outcomes? Are they public about, you know, maybe their blood work or, you know, their medications as a whole, or hopefully few or none in terms of medications? So are they doing all of that? Is someone living by the values that they advocate for? Now, that's more to do with unusual stuff. So if somebody says, you need food in order to survive, or you need to breathe in order to survive, we don't take that with a lot of skepticism, because that's kind of understood, that's kind of mainstream, that's basic biology. And so in the some way says, if somebody says, a strong marriage, family values, Christian principles, announces his divorce from his wife after a long marriage and raising 7 children together, does this undermine the credibility of all his prior teachings on those topics? I don't think so. If somebody has really good advice on how to quit drugs and then encounter some particular life stressor, ends up back on those drugs, it doesn't invalidate everything that they said before. And requiring perfection in order to accept a belief system is a way of avoiding any strictness in belief systems. And it's kind of true, of course. I mean, I think I have this habit. I think everyone has this habit to some degree, where the fall from grace is greeted with a kind of relief. Because if somebody says, you know, here's how to live, here's what to do, here's how to be, and then that person has a fairly spectacular fall from grace, you know, the pride goeth before a fall, and there is a relief of tension. I mean, we all want to do good, we all want to be honest, but it's tough. I mean, it's tough being honest in a world that thrives and survives on lies. So when we see a moralist fall from grace, it gives us a little bit of relief. Like, we are suspended between the angels and the animals. We are absolutely suspended between the angels and the animals. And we are drawn upwards to the angelic, and we are drawn downwards towards the animalistic, because we evolved from animals, and yet we participate in universal morals, abstractions, and virtues. So we are torn in two, like this medieval torture where they'd get horses to pull a person apart. We're kind of torn in two. I would love to be abstract, moral, John Galt, Socrates, heroic guy, but at the same time, I'm also drawn towards animal pleasures and cunning and all of that sort of stuff. I think this is a fairly, comes to mind-body dichotomy, right? It's a fairly common thing in society as a whole. There's things that I do that are physically very enjoyable, and they cut into the time that I can do philosophy. And I, of course, wish to tell the truth and to be humble, but of course, there's also vanity and the desire to be right. I sort of noticed that on X, everything I promote as the good is kind of stuff I've already done, right? Like, oh, you gotta do manual labor to really ground yourself in reality. Hey, I did manual labor. You know, got to work out. Hey, I work out. You know what I mean? I have to sort of watch that I don't put myself forward as a template of the definition of the good person or the good life and so on, right? Which is why I'm often telling people, I tell people as a whole, I try never to feel superior, and particularly when I'm talking to younger people. You've heard me say this a million times, like, you're further ahead than I was at your age. And, you know, we're all down here in the trenches with these battles. I'm not trying to lecture you from any place of superiority, right? So the humility is, I think, really, really important. So I work on that kind of stuff. And so when we see someone who is taking on battles and surviving, if not thriving, part of us wants to take on those same battles. But part of us also wants to hide from those battles, keep our heads low, and find a way to survive, because that's what almost all of our ancestors, I mean, like with maybe four exceptions, Almost all of our ancestors, when faced with political power, with the power of the tribe, the power of the witch doctors, and so on, simply nodded, kept their head down, found a way to reproduce, and survived. So that's what we do. And so we want to take on the battles. We want to do the right thing. We also want to survive. And it's attention. Tell the truth, put yourself in danger. Lie and feel humiliated. It's either physical danger or the danger of self-reproach. I mean, I do want to, you know, I'm going to be 60 in a couple of months, so I am sort of thinking about life as a whole and the last decade or two, or hopefully a little more. And I do sort of want to get to the end of my life and say, I did as much philosophy as I could. I pushed the needle to the red. So I got as much interesting, challenging, exciting philosophy out there in the world as I could, which means tell as much truth for as long as possible, which means don't get killed, right? So when we see a moralist fall from grace, it releases or reduces some of that tension that we have, which is to ascend to the angelic or to descend to the bestial, to the animal, to the hedonistic, to the cunning, to the survival, to the bob and weave, the dodge and reproduce, lay low, find a way to survive, you know, slave reproduction. And that sounds like it's a big condemnation. I don't mean it in that way at all. I mean, I'm glad that my ancestors did not ascend to the angelic, because ascending to the angelic usually means joining the angels in death. So it doesn't, I say, undermine the credibility of all his prior teachings on those topics. Well, let's take a silly example. There is a great math teacher who becomes senile and forgets all of his proofs. He gets Alzheimer's or something like that, and he becomes senile. And he forgets all of his proofs, and he can no longer explain the Pythagorean theorem or Fermat's last theorem or things like that, right? Does that mean that his prior mathematical teachings are false? No. No, of course not, right? Arnold Schwarzenegger does not look as good now as he did in his 20s. I mean, it's staging, right? He's a great guy as far as health goes. He's done a lot of good with regards to health and all of that, but he obviously does not look as good now as he did in his 20s, right? It makes sense. Does that mean that his education about health, exercise, nutrition is invalid? Well, no, he's just aging, right? Now, of course, we hope that people who have moral ideals are going to continue to follow them, particularly as they age, but not always. And sometimes it's going to be because of physical decay, and sometimes it could be for other reasons of health. So, for instance, let's say that his wife, when she hit this woman, this man's wife, when she went through menopause, became unstable, which can happen, right? Hormones. I don't know if you've ever had it. I had it where I had a little cyst removed and I couldn't exercise for a couple of weeks. And I got a little aggressive. And I could feel that sort of temper in me. And so it could be that for reasons to do with hormonal imbalances or other things that she became unstable. It could be that she had a brain tumor or a brain injury or something like that, which caused her personality to fundamentally change. And so these things can happen. He also, right, the prominent Christian teacher, it could also be that he encountered a philosophical argument or a scientific argument that undermined his faith. Or it could be that she encountered a philosophical or scientific argument that undermined her faith. And that could be the case as well. It could be, instead of moving further away from faith, it could be that one partner in the marriage moved closer and closer to faith. In other words, they prayed to God, and God said, I need you to give up all your worldly possessions, you know, sell everything you own, give the money to the poor, and follow me. It could be that somebody has a religious vision or a perceived encounter with the divine that causes an escalation in the pursuit of faith that is not acceptable to the other person. It could be, if this person was prominent, and you know that some of the, it's true of religious leaders as a whole, I know a little bit more about the Christians, that some of the Christian preachers, the sort of televangelist style, they are, well, you know, God needs me to have this private jet so I can do the Lord's work, and God needs me to have three Rolls-Royce cars so I can do the Lord's work, and so on. So it could be that, let's say, the man has had a vision or an encounter in his mind with the divine, and God says to him, you have become too shallow, too materialistic, too concerned with status, too concerned with money, you own too many things, this all needs to change. And then he begins the process of divesting resources. Could happen to the wife as well, and the other partner finds that unacceptable. Could be anything to do with that. And so there could be a number of reasons as to why this could have happened. It could also have happened that for some reason or other, and this again can be to do with hormones, it can be to do with prior trauma that is emerging, like in my opinion, a lot of postpartum depression has to do with prior infant trauma in the mother. Generally, it's the mother re-emerging as she holds her baby. So it could be that, let's say, the wife has developed a revulsion for sexual activity. For some reason, could be hormonal, could be prior trauma, could be physiological or something like that. And you know, if this is a healthy man, he wants to have sex. If his wife is not having sex with him for whatever reason, then that could be a problem as well. Is that a form of adultery? I think so, yeah. I think it is a form of cheating to not have sex with your partner, assuming no major medical issues, of course. So if somebody says a strong marriage, yeah, I mean, that just sounds nice, right? It just sounds nice. Like strong body, okay, but family values and Christian principles announces this divorce. I think what is tough is that divorce is brutal, of course, on the family as a whole. Divorce is brutal on the community. And this person, I think it's a man, his divorce, yeah. So if he's going to announce his divorce, I think he needs to do it in a way that is comprehensible to his audience. So if he has gained credibility because he has a strong marriage and he pronounces these family values, Christian values, and fidelity and monogamy and commitment to marriage and so on. So if he has gained his credibility as in part as a result of his marriage, if the marriage fails, he needs to follow the thou shalt not bear false witness. Thou shalt not bear false witness. Which means if he has invited credibility into his life as the result of his strong marriage, if his marriage breaks apart, he needs to be honest as to why. And I don't know, this we grew apart kind of stuff, you know, people tend to minimize the reasons for divorce. And the reasons for divorce are usually pretty brutal. Usually pretty brutal. And if people minimize it, like, oh, it's just a conscious uncoupling, we just kind of vaguely drifted apart, or I traveled a lot and we're just not as close as you. Like, you can fix all of that, right? You can fix all of that. And so, if you have made your marriage public, then I think, again, based on Christian principles of thou shalt not bear false witness, which means tell the truth in important matters, thou shalt not, it doesn't say thou shalt not lie, it says thou shalt not bear false witness. Now, witnesses, like think of a courtroom, right? These are sort of very big and important moral issues. You know, I don't think you go to hell if somebody says, how are you doing today? You have a headache, but you say, not bad, I'm fine. I don't think that's a going to hell situation, so. Okay, I hope that makes sense. Somebody asked, was there ever a time in the history of the universe where nothing existed? Well, sorry to be pedantic, nothing can't exist. Nothing is the absence of existence. I just did a show last night on the monstrous lie of 95% of physics is cosmological physics, intergalactic physics, is based on made-up matter and energy for which there's no evidence. There's a need for it, but there's no evidence for it. So there is the Big Bang, which is infinitesimally small, singularity point of energy triggers some sort of explosion, and the matter goes out, and over tens of thousands of years cools and transforms into atoms in that equals mc squared formula. So it's interesting, of course, if the universe has an origin point but no end point, then what physicists say is, well, we have no idea what caused 13.8 billion years ago the universe to explode into existence, so to speak. And of course, I understand that God is not much of an answer, but when physicists say, well, maybe the matter came in from another dimension, that's also not any kind of answer as well. So certainly if we go back to 13.9 billion years, as far as I understand it, there was no universe, because the universe is time, space, matter, and energy, and it kind of started. You know, whether there is a big bang, big crunch, universe goes out, comes back in, like a giant cosmic heartbeat, there's not much evidence for that, unless they start really tweaking the attraction or repulsion properties of dark energy. So there was a time in the history of the universe where nothing existed as we understand it now. So that is certainly the case. All right. I said something can't come from nothing, so the answer is no. God has always existed and was never created. Certainly seems a little bit more credible to me than it was a couple of days ago. All right. He says, I have two sons that I have raised as a single dad. They're great boys, and I took some advice from you about peaceful parenting long ago. Thank you for that, by the way. One of my sons has recently fallen prey to this particularly strong political rhetoric and so on. How do I bring him back? Well, that's a good question. How do you bring people back from what would, I hate to be harsh or extremist because those aren't really good descriptions of belief systems, but let's just say your son believes things that you believe are false. Your son believes things that you believe are false. Well, the most important thing to do is to listen to the beliefs. Don't oppose them. Listen to the beliefs. I mean, I believe some things my daughter thinks is false. Everyone in my life believes things that I don't believe to one degree or another. And I believe things that people in my life don't believe. And that's fine, right? We have conversations, and we all try and polish this disco ball into some kind of truth radiator. So how do you bring him back? Well, you have to listen and examine the logic and evidence behind what he believes. So we end up with false beliefs because we are given bad evidence and have good reasoning, or we are given good evidence and we have bad reasoning. And of course, it's possible that we're given bad evidence and we have bad reasoning and so on, but it's the reason and evidence. The evidence comes first. What is the evidence for your belief? Is there any way to chip away at that evidence? Is that evidence true, or is that evidence false? Well, you would look at the evidence and do your own research and watch the videos that have, or the whatever it is that has caused him to have these perspectives or beliefs, hopefully more than opinions. So you dig into the evidence, and if the evidence is false, then you provide counter evidence, and you don't have to argue the reasoning because you are overturning the evidence, right? I mean, if your son believes, I'm not saying he does, right? If he believes you let go of an egg and it floats in the air, right? You don't need to go through all the reasoning. You just need to disprove that by holding an egg and letting it go and it drops, right? So look at the evidence behind his beliefs and find out if the beliefs are false. Then either it's bad evidence, in which case the reasoning that follows after bad evidence doesn't really matter, because it's, if you say all men are octopi, Socrates is a man, therefore Socrates is an octopi, you don't need to look at the last two parts, right, of the syllogism. You just need to look at the principle, right? In logic, all men are octopi, Socrates is a man, therefore Socrates is an octopi, is valid. In other words, it follows syllogistic logical structures. It's just false because men aren't octopi. That's octopuses in a pie, just for those who are, when the 3.14159628 limbs. So look at the evidence. Now, if the evidence is strong, then the false beliefs must come from bad reasoning from good evidence. Bad reasoning from good evidence. So let's say that many years ago in the past, before photos and social media, let's say that your son grew up in a town or in a little village or a tribe where there were only redheads, like Scottish or Irish or something like that. And so he says, all human beings have red hair. Now, the evidence is strong. Every human being around him has red hair. So you can't say that he's wrong in terms of the evidence. You could say it's incomplete and you know, so on, right? So everyone around me is a human being. Everyone around me has red hair. Therefore, all human beings have red hair. Well, of course, the error is in the last part, in that you can't extrapolate from personal experience to all humans. You can say all humans have teeth, or at least all humans are born with teeth, and, you know, except for some very, very strange genetic mutations I can't even conceive of, and that is kind of true. Or you can call it eye teeth, right? You ever see a baby skull? It's kind of freaky. So if it's bad evidence, then you simply overturn the evidence and the reasoning falls from there. If it's good evidence, then there's false beliefs, it's bad reasoning from there. So with the redhead example, that's good evidence, but you can't extrapolate to all humans just from the humans around you, right? So if there's good evidence and good reasoning, well, then I'm afraid you have to be willing to be convinced. So these are just general structure, right? What is the meaning of life? Meaning arises out of not fulfilling your potential. The question of meaning. I don't question the meaning of my life. I do good works. I battle evil. I promote virtue. I live semi-dangerously and so on. So I don't worry about the meaning of my life. It never even really crosses my mind. Like, what's the meaning of all of this, right? So in general, it is, I'm not calling you a coward, but in general, it is cowardice that generates the problem of meaning. If you actively promote virtue and you fight evil and you have an interesting, exciting life because of that, you have your victories, you have your losses, and so on, then you don't worry about meaning. All right. Somebody says, I think you underestimate how shitty and warped the current dating market is for young people. Certainly, it's always possible. I do actually know quite a few young people. A lot of my listeners are younger. I've had endless conversations with young people, both publicly and privately, about some of these challenges. So it's no question. Yeah, women have been programmed and the men have been programmed and so on. However, so here's the challenge that I face. The challenge that I face is if the young men around were demonstrably high quality, right? They had good oral hygiene, white teeth, they took care of their skin, they had good haircuts, they had good posture, they exercised, they dressed reasonably well. I'm not talking about seeing some Adam Ant Fop dandy planet, but, you know, dressed reasonably well. They had good eye contact, they firm handshake, they had some reasonable conversational skills, they were, you don't have to be some stand-up comic, but, you know, some reasonable ability to be funny, to make people laugh. Women desperately need men to make them laugh because women have a tendency to fall into over-seriousness and men have a tendency to fall into over-frivolity. And so the weight of the woman and the helium of the man tend to produce stability over time. So when I look around as a whole, as I sort of roam through life and see things as I do, I see a lot more women taking care of their appearance than men. And it's a fairly common observation that there seem to be a lot more attractive women than there are attractive men. And I'm not talking about things beyond your control, like your bone structure or your height or things like that. I'm just talking about a sense of grooming, a sense of presentation, and so on, right? So women, young women go to what to me would be, obviously as a man, fairly excessive lengths to find, you know, cute outfits and to figure out what the right haircut is and to make sure that they are attractive and presentable and so on. And I see a lot of young men slouching around with the copy-paste broccoli haircut, some pretty bad skin, and no eye contact. I don't know if it comes from some of the furtiveness of pornography addiction or maybe just video game, bad posture stuff or whatever, but there's just not a lot of confidence. Now, I sympathize with young men about that because there has been, particularly young white men, just massive assault on their confidence, self-esteem. I totally get that, and I really do sympathize with that. However, there is, of course, the internet, which wasn't around when I was a young man going through a lot of the same misogyny. It wasn't quite as anti-white, but it certainly was anti-male, the stuff that I went through as a kid. So I didn't have the counterweight of the internet for that kind of stuff. So the propaganda wasn't as intense, but the counter-propaganda was virtually non-existent. Maybe you could go to the library and come across some book that might help you with counter-arguments, but that was hard. You didn't even know they existed. You wouldn't know where to find them, and you didn't know which ones were any good. So it's true, propaganda has escalated since I was young, but counter-propaganda has increased much more than propaganda. And of course, young people, young men in particular, tend to be skeptical of all forms of authority, as they should be. So when I look around, as I do, I sort of note the young women seem to be putting a fair amount of care into their appearance, and the young men are not in particular. And young men also appear to be somewhat skittish. Now, of course, I get, you know, that there's some women who you approach them, they'll put you on blast on social media, that can be a problem. And so I get all of that, for sure. I get all of that. But it wasn't like those problems were non-existent in my generation. I mean, if you approached the wrong girl in high school and she made fun of you and put you on blast in the high school, okay, it wasn't Instagram, but it still had a pretty strong effect on your dating prospects. So all of that stuff was a challenge as well. The internet is just high school writ large. And of course, but when you're 15 or 16 or 17 years old, high school is your world, right? So I get all of that. The current dating market is warped for young people. There's also an aspect where, and I've talked about this with some call-in show people as well, that someone says, well, let's say I'm an agnostic, and I met this girl, I kind of like her, but she's somewhat religious, and therefore it's not going to work. I strongly disagree with that as a whole. Most people, and I say this also including myself when I was young too, most people, they don't know what they believe. When I was younger, I was a socialist because socialism just seemed like a positive, nice, friendly, helpful, you know, all the propaganda that goes along with it. And so if some capitalist girl had met me and I said, I'm a socialist, and if she said, well, I'm not going to date a guy who's a socialist, well, how about you try to teach people something? Most people, when they're young, do not know why they believe. They don't even know what they believe. They just have a bunch of slogans stuffed in their head, and they have been rewarded and punished for compliance with these belief structures. So if you meet a woman, let's say you're an atheist, you meet a woman who's somewhat religious, well, talk to her. Ask her questions, her history. You can talk to her about your perspective. I mean, somebody doesn't have to believe what you believe when you meet them. Now, of course, if you believe that you shouldn't pour whiskey on hobos, and she's like, no, I think you should. Okay, that's a moral thing. That's a sort of a different example, right? If she's very keen on shoplifting, right, then that might be it. But in terms of just general philosophical beliefs, beliefs about reality and truth and so on, if she's a relativist and you're an absolutist when it comes to morals, okay, so maybe you can be chipped away at things, and maybe you're an absolutist in things that are a bit more relative. Maybe she can be shored up in some of the core stuff. So you can exchange values and virtues with each other. My wife and I did not believe all the same things when we met, but I think there's been a cross-pollination that has been positive. So I think, I mean, women have been heavily propagandized, and it's not women's fault, fundamentally, that they've been so heavily propagandized. Women, biologically, in my view, I mean, women score very high in the Big Five personality trait called agreeableness, which means that they find it very tough to dissent from the group. Men, boys, find it much easier to dissent from the group. And that's, I personally think that's hardwired. So it's not quite the same as blaming women for having breasts, but it's not the opposite either. So women are easier, young women in particular, are easier to program because they are more susceptible to group consensus. And that's out of evolution, and there's positive reasons for that. But that's why, you know, that's why in the Garden of Eden, the serpent, Satan, goes for Eve, not Adam, because Eve is more susceptible to being talked into and out of things. Consensus is essential. Now, of course, remember, women, it's really hard to understand female nature without remembering that women were regularly conquered throughout history. And women who were able to adapt to the new consensus of the new rulers got to reproduce. Women who fought to the death to oppose the new rulers didn't reproduce. Probably just got killed or something like that, right? Or sold into slavery or something like that. So women have to have a bit of a weather vane changing consensus because they tend to survive invasions because of their, I mean, young women in particular, youth and fertility. And of course, a lot of invasions are for females. So women just have a bit of a weather vane consensus thing. Not all women, blah, 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 right? It's a little bit more than men. And so the idea that you have to take people as they are when you meet them and not work to reason with them and let them reason with you and find some truth that is in the middle or cross-pollination and so on, it's not valid. It's not reasonable. You're not going to meet someone who's just like yourself. And if you do, that's actually not a good thing. If I met someone who was just like myself when I was 16, 17, 18, I wouldn't have grown. We would have just nodded at each other and told each other how right and true and wonderful and perfect we were, and I wouldn't have grown. So, sure, the dating market is bad. Again, I'm not talking to the general public. I'm talking to the top 1% of intelligence, people who can follow these arguments, who are willing to accept these perspectives and follow this reasoning. It's smart people, top 1%. So, if I'm training Olympic athletes and they say, well, but the pickup games around me are of low quality, I'd say, well, sure, but we're not aiming to put you into a pickup game in the local neighborhood. We're aiming to put you on the gold podium at the Olympics. So, of course, if you're a listener to this show, this conversation, you are looking for an unusually high quality, thoughtful, reasonable woman. And she's looking for you too, and she's not finding it among most of the men, and you're not finding it among most of the women. So if you want to get into the NBA and you say, but most people in my neighborhood aren't good at basketball, I would say to you, well, yes, by definition, that's true. But you want to find people who are great at basketball so you can improve your skills and get to the NBA or something like that. So sure, it is the case. Like, so half of women have tattoos, half of young women in America, I think it is, have tattoos. That's terrible. That's terrible. But you're not looking for half of women, if you're a listener to this show. You're looking for 1%, 2% of women. Now, the fact that a lot of women have crazy hair colors, obese, septum piercings, tattoos, slovenly, chaotic, debt-ridden, whatever, right? So, yeah, but you're not trying to date the majority of people. You're trying to find the diamond, and she's trying to find you. So, don't look at the average. If you're a listener to the show, don't look at the average and feel despair, right? If you're a fantastic musician and you say, well, geez, man, most of the people around me, they don't even play any music. I'm never going to make it. It's like you got to find, you know, your Steven Tyler, Joe Perry, your Art and Garfunkel, your like whatever partnership or pairing is going to be a David Lee Roth and Eddie Van Halen or whatever. Guitarist and singer is kind of a combo. So you are going to want to find the people at your level. And that means discarding the vast majority of people. You know, the band Genesis, after Peter Gabriel left, if I remember rightly, it's either some like, they auditioned like 200 singers or maybe it was 400 singers. they couldn't find the right fit, and then Phil Collins, the drummer, took on the vocal duties. He's got a slightly nasal but very distinctive voice, and a distinctive voice is very key, right? When Anderson, Bruford, Wakeman, and Howe were working on a pretty great album that they did after Yes broke up, you know, one of the reasons that John Anderson got involved was that the record producer said, I mean, the singing is nice, but you need somebody with a more distinctive voice. Because a distinctive voice, you know, like Sting's or John Anderson's or Phil Collins or whatever, like where you hear someone on the radio and it doesn't sound like just about everybody else, that's very important. It's a branding. It's a differentiator. And so, yeah, the band Genesis went through hundreds of singers trying to find a singer, and it didn't work. They couldn't find one. And these are people, you know, like the guy who sang the Mike and Mechanic songs, Living Years, I think it's called. I mean, that guy could sing the phone book. He's an amazing singer. Or Paul Young, also when he was in his 80s prime, you know, Wherever I Lay My Hat and Wonderland and Love of the Common People, fantastic songs. He also wrote a song, actually, gosh, what was it? Just a kiss of me. A Broken Man. Broken Man. Listen to that. It's an amazing song. I didn't like it when I first heard it. But anyway, very distinctive voice. You know who it is. So if you want to be a top musician, you can't just look around and say, oh my God, people are just bad. You know, I can't do karaoke. They can only play three chords and chopsticks, and maybe most of them don't even touch. Oh my God, I'm never going to make it. It's like, but you're not looking for the average. You're looking for the exceptional. If you listen to this show, you're looking for the exceptional. Stop wallowing around in the average and losing hope. So I hope that makes sense. Last question. Where does courage come from? How does a person become courageous? So courage is based on support. Most people are not courageous because they know they're going to be betrayed. So let's say that for some reason you're squaring off against, you and four friends are squaring off against five guys. Now, if you know for a simple fact that your four friends are going to fight honorably and bravely and with great resolution against these five guys, then you rush in knowing that there's people with you. If, however, you're pretty sure that three of your five friends are just going to cut and run, then you lose courage. Courage is to do with support, which is why when someone like me acts with a reasonable amount of courage, the powers that be aim to separate me from support, right? So they deplatform me and tell terrible falsehoods about me, and then people don't follow me, as like 97% of my audience didn't follow me to new platforms. And so then I am without loyal, staunch companions on the field of intellectual battle. And so it's not cowardice to refuse to fight when most of your, quote, allies run away. That's reasonable. That's rational, because otherwise you're just going to get the crap kicked out of you for no particular purpose and you can't possibly win, right? So courage is to some degree an internal state, but courage comes from support in your environment. And if you are supported in your environment, then you can be courageous. Courage is built, first of all, you want to look at the long term, and you want to have not an excess of courage nor a deficiency of courage. And courage, the opposite of courage is not cowardice. The opposite of courage is regret. Because if you run from a fight that was important and virtuous and you had a reasonable chance of winning, if you run from that fight, then you have regret. And so you want to avoid future regret. But of course, if you do something that's over-courageous and then you get wrecked or destroyed or something like that, then you'll also have that kind of regret, which is, oh, why did I do that? That turned out to be a bad idea. I shouldn't have done it, blah, 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 right? I mean, if you go and take on five guys with only you and a friend because three friends ran away and you get both your arms broken, then you're going to be like, well, that was dumb, right? Like, I mean, poor Michael Hutchins, right? Not a great guy by any stretch, but, you know, good singer. He got into some stupid fight with a cab driver, and the cab driver punched him, and he fell, cracked his head, and didn't get treated for the resulting brain injury, and got darker and darker, and couldn't smell, couldn't taste, and got very depressed, and ended up, apparently, killed himself. Was it worth it, fighting with the cab driver? Nope! Absolutely not. Absolutely not. Or, is it Bono from U2 was biking in New York City, fell off his bike, and wrecked his arm to the point where he can't even play guitar. And as The Edge pointed out, it's really not necessary for his musical success that he play guitar. But if he looks at that bike ride, or whatever he did on the bike ride, was it a worthwhile bike ride to wreck his arm so he can't play guitar? No. So you have regret, right? You have regret. So a courage is having the long-term perspective to avoid regret, either the regret of too much courage or the regret of too little courage. But most importantly, courage is based upon who you choose to be your allies. We can't win fights alone. Who you choose to be your allies is foundational to the amount of courage you can express. freedomain.com/donate. Thank you guys so much. Sorry for the slightly long ramble at the beginning. It took me a little while to find the right grooves at that, but I didn't feel like re-recording. So freedomain.com/donate to help out the show. I would really appreciate it. call.freedomain.com. Let's have a conversation. I look forward to hearing from you. All the best. Bye.